From Chicago Public Radio, this is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. As everyone by now knows, the American mission in Iraq is being carried out only partly by American soldiers. In addition to U.S. military personnel, the American authorities have hired a large number of civilians to perform various tasks. Their jobs range from the mundane, like maintaining supplies, to very significant activities that would seem to be close to the core operations of the mission, such as conducting interrogations of Iraqi detainees. These civilian workers face many of the same risks that soldiers do. Several incidents have made this clear. The ambush and mutilation of four private contractors in Fallujah, for example, or the kidnapping of Thomas Hamill, the Mississippi dairy farmer who was in Iraq driving a truck. These incidents and the coverage that they've received in the press have made non-military actors into a prominent and complicated part of the story of Iraq. Who are these workers? Who are these workers? Where do they come from? And how does their presence in Iraq affect the way that we might consider or judge the American military effort there? Today on Odyssey, we're going to explore the ways in which private contractors might complicate our sense of the situation in Iraq. Joining us for the conversation are two political scientists. From Washington, D.C., we are joined by Deborah Avant. Hello, Deborah Avant. Welcome back to the program.
Hello. Nice to be here.
With us in Lexington, Kentucky, is Michael Desch. Hi, Michael Desch. Welcome back to Odyssey.
Hi, Gretchen.
Thanks for being with us. Mike Desch, let me just ask you to give us some basic facts here. How many of these private contractors are, and what do they do?
Well, the Department of Defense officially owns up to about 20,000 contractors supporting Operation Iraqi Freedom. But most people, I think, agree that that figure is probably too low. And the figures I've heard have been anywhere from 25,000 to 35,000. So it's a pretty big slug of the number of people who are there, or at least Americans who are there, fall into this nebulous category of contractor.
What's the size of that group compared to soldiers?
Well, there are 135,000 U.S. forces in Iraq itself, so, you know, that basically is almost 20 to 25%, depending upon which number you go with.
And how close do they get, do these private contractors get, to the types of jobs that soldiers do? I mean, are they doing just support stuff, or are they doing basic military missions?
Well, it really spans the gamut from, you know, people doing combat service support and combat support type things that, you know, can be conducted, you know, way behind the lines. People working for Halliburton or Kellogg Brown and Root, you know, who are slinging hash in the mess hall, to people that are, you know, actually operating, you know, right up near the front edge of combat with the soldiers. A brother-in-law of mine was a missile tech for Lockheed Martin and worked with the Marines on the Hawk missile battery. And when they were initially deployed in Afghanistan, he was there wearing BDUs and, you know, operating with the Marines at Bagram Airport.
BDUs, so, battle dress uniform.
Right, battle dress utilities.
Okay.
So the point is that you can have contractors pretty close to the pointy edge of the spear, not just doing, you know, what one would think of as purely civilian type jobs like, you know, janitorial work or construction or driving trucks or things like that.
Well, are there rules about how close they can get? I mean, does the American government have a limit and say you can get this close, but there are certain jobs that must be done by soldiers?
I'm not sure that there are real clear limits at this point. You know, there a lot of the positions that are being filled are, you know, now by contractors or positions where people are carrying arms and are expected to use those arms in certain circumstances. So, you know, I think, you know, de facto, the line is really blurring.
Deborah Avant, why is it that we're seeing so many more of these private contractors in this conflict than we saw in the past?
Well, in some ways, you can think of it as an extension of the trend that began with the all-volunteer force. It really escalated, though, in the 90s, partly because the forces were downsized at the same time that the number of engagements that U.S. forces were required to participate in went up. So at the same time, to add another feature, there have been changes in the nature of conflict that have both made more technical jobs part of the military. And also in the 90s and in Iraq, a lot of the things that the U.S. wanted to do in the world required governance, policing kind of work, and private contractors do those kinds of things well.
Well, so let's dig in a little bit more on the issue of the all-volunteer force, because people have talked about this a lot recently as a major feature of our military, that there's been this move in the last couple decades to this all-volunteer force. But is the significant fact there that we have a military that doesn't require a draft, or is the significant fact here that these people are doing more difficult jobs, that this is a more professional military than it was, say, back in World War II?
Well, I think it's both of those things. The all-volunteer force is often referred to as something that is a sort of post-draft phenomena. But certainly the kinds of skills that are required in military forces have increased. And with that, the level of professionalization and the level of commitment to the job.
Why is it that, one more question about this long-term process, why is it that if the jobs are more technical, they're more likely to be privatized? I mean, I don't quite understand. Why don't we just train our own soldiers to do those things?
Well, partly it's because the amount of skill that you might need might change quickly over time. You may need to stay up to the latest in, sort of technological expertise in ways that the private sector might do more effectively than the military. And it's also that if you're a force planner and you're trying to decide how many people in a particular specialization you're going to need, you have to do that far in advance. If you can hire from the private sector, you can do it, you can turn on a dime. So it provides you with a little more flexibility to adjust to changes that you might not be able to anticipate long enough in advance to, you know, to have your force structure right.
Mike Desch, how similar are these private contractors to soldiers in terms of the kind of training that they have, the kinds of maybe values or even ethical guidelines that they operate under?
Well, I don't think you can say across the board because it really varies from specialty to specialty. This fellow you referred to before, Thomas Hamill, who was driving a truck for KBR, I don't think was ever in the military and certainly had no real military training aside from the orientation that he got before he went overseas. But take the four contractors who were killed in Fallujah. These guys were all ex-military, most of them from the special operations community, and really just recently separated. So the difference between those guys versus people who are still in uniform would actually be very small. They don't wear uniforms. They aren't subject to the same chain of command or the uniform code of military justice. But a lot of the contractors that are doing more combat-related specialties, or the people in intelligence and interrogation, often are professionals who've come out recently and are being hired back in because they have skills that are in demand.
And so the move, in some sense, their backgrounds are really close, and it seems like it's a, like you can describe it as a small move. They leave the military, they go work for a private company doing more or less the same thing. But how dramatic a change is that in terms of who they answer to, what sorts of rules they follow? Mike Desch.
Well, in one respect, it's not much of a change at all, because you have people separated from the service who are coming back in and doing things that, you know, in many cases they were doing for 20 or 25 years. But on the other hand, they're doing it outside of the normal chain of command. They're doing it, as we discovered in the debacle at Abu Ghraib, outside of the usual restrictions that apply to soldiers on active duty, and it's added a different complexion, to the conduct of operations, than what we've seen before. I think there's no denying that.
You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. We're talking today on the program about the presence of private contractors in Iraq and how their presence might be affecting the way we perceive the situation there. Deborah Avent, let me ask this. This may sound like a weird question, but how are we, the American public, supposed to feel about these guys, especially when they are in danger or when they get killed?
Well, I don't know how we're supposed to feel, but people appear to feel have some kind of mixed feelings about contractors. Certainly, when you saw the press coverage surrounding the Fallujah incident, there was a lot of, there were some people that said those are Americans, they were killed, that's horrible. There were some people who said, what were they doing there? Were they there just for the money? And you even saw in the media coverage many of the reporters feeling like they had to explain what it meant to be a contractor. And in fact, there was some confusion among people hearing about the event. When they heard the word contractor, they weren't sure if that was a construction worker or if that was an armed guard. And so I think that there's a lot of ambiguity in how people feel about these contractors right now, simply because this is a somewhat new phenomenon to be faced with.
Do you think that it matters how we feel about them? I mean, do you think that the complicated reaction, that we might need to figure out how we feel about them? Let's put it that way.
I think it does matter. A lot of the way we think about the legitimate use of force in the modern nation state in general, but certainly in the United States and in the last, in our lifetimes, has been connected with the fact that we do use public forces and citizens to go abroad and fight our wars, whether they're drafted or part of an all-volunteer military force. The contractors that are working in Iraq right now, even American companies like Blackwater, whose employees were killed in Fallujah, are recruiting internationally. And so we have not only retired American special operations forces, but also retired forces from Chile and South Africa and UK and Israel and a variety of other countries that are operating, under contract with these firms. And so how we feel about that is going to need to be sorted out, and how much these contractors really represent the United States, and if not, who they represent, is something that I think we're going to be struggling with.
Mike Desch, just briefly, what are you seeing in terms of the way people are reacting to these sort of, we have to take a break, but are you seeing anything about people's feelings about these contractors?
I don't think that the American public fully appreciates the extent to which contractors are playing a role in Iraq. And I think to the extent that they're paying attention, it's more in terms of attacks on Americans. But they're not thinking, through fully the implications of how large the contractor presence is.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will think through a little more fully the contractor presence and its meaning for the way we think about and perceive the American mission in Iraq. Stay with us. More to come. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Today on the program, we are talking about private contractors in Iraq and the way that their presence there might be affecting our perceptions of the situation and of the U.S. military effort there. Our guests today are Michael Desch, who is a political scientist at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. He is the director of the Patterson School of Diplomacy there and the author of Civilian Control of the Military, The Changing Security Environment. We're also talking with Deborah Avant, who's a political scientist at George Washington University. She is the author of a forthcoming book called The Market for Force, Private Security and Political Change, which examines the global trend toward privatizing security and military services. Deborah Avant, I want to dig in a little more on what effect the presence of these private contractors is having. We can think about them and you know, make decisions about what they are doing, but I wonder if you think whether their presence there affects the way we think about and evaluate what soldiers are doing there.
Well, their presence does affect what soldiers do on the ground, there's a couple of different ways that matters. One, of course, is that if you use contractors to provide support services, more soldiers can be devoted toward doing the sort of their core military tasks. And those kinds of arrangements work pretty well. In Iraq, though, we've seen a greater blending of the kinds of roles that are provided by the private sector and the kind of roles that are provided by soldiers. And that creates more confusion. Some active duty personnel returning from Iraq have told me that they felt confused and didn't want to be anywhere near private security contractors because they weren't sure what their rules were and how to interact with them. And that's partly a function of the fact that these contractors are not only working for the U.S. government in Iraq, they're also working for the private sector, for NGOs, for a variety of different kinds of entities. And so having these different kinds of forces on the ground really complicates a battlefield scenario. And of course, we're not talking about forces on a traditional battlefield. A lot of what's happening in the insurgency in Iraq is, you know, forces that might be operating in similar parts of a city, and that makes for very confusing rules of engagement.
Mike Desch, do you think that the work of the contractors might affect the way we assess or what we say about the work of soldiers? And, you know, we think about soldiers as making sacrifices, as serving their country in a way that it seems like we don't about private contractors. But I'm wondering if there is an effect back onto the way we evaluate soldiers. What do you see?
Well, as I said before, I'm not sure that the public has fully appreciated the extent to which the contractor presence in Iraq is contributing to our efforts there. I guess I'm old enough to remember the 1960s and the 1970s when there was a lot of discussion of a related phenomenon. That was the use of private soldiers in various third world conflicts, primarily in Africa. And there the image of mercenaries was a pretty unsavory one. And, you know, I think if you'd ask most Americans what they thought about people selling their services for money in war, they would have wrinkled their nose or something like that. But you don't really see that, at least thus far, in terms of the discussion of what, mercenaries are doing in Iraq. To the extent that the public has thought about this, they're thinking about these as American civilians who are over there helping out with what's going on. And that, you know, was sort of the overwhelming response to the killing of those four Blackwater employees in Fallujah.
But now, you would call these people mercenaries?
Yeah, by the technical definition of the term, the guys that were working for Blackwater were essentially hired guns. And, you know, they're providing security for Iraqi provisional government or for various U.S. government agencies or for NGOs and IGOs, but they fit the literal definition of mercenary. Yeah.
I don't, what is the literal definition of mercenary?
Somebody who fights for money, not for national allegiance. And this goes back to a point that Debbie had raised a little bit earlier. I mean, our image of soldiers has, you know, at least for the past couple of hundred years, has been of people who are fighting not for money, but fighting as part of their civic obligation to the country. Now, that's changed, you know, even in terms of the American military with the advent of the all-volunteer force, although I think in the public mind, we still think of American soldiers as soldiers in the old view. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that the trend towards the privatization or at least marketization of military force has really been going on for a long time now. It's just, I think, more apparent in the 90s and currently, you know, primarily because we're so short in troops in the active force.
Deborah Avant, did you want to say something?
No, not that.
Well, let me ask you a question. What do you see happening, or do you see anything happening, with respect to this connection between citizens and a citizen army and that what that might mean for military service and the presence, in particular, the high visibility of these contractors in Iraq? I mean, does it affect the way we think about whether our soldiers are actually serving us in the way we have understood them to serve us in the past?
Well, part of that will depend on what we know. You know, one of the things that's interesting is, of course, the press covers military forces. When we send military forces abroad, media personnel are not embedded with the contractors. They're embedded with the forces. And so the media coverage of contractors is less. And I think that, you know, Mike is right in alluding to the fact that people haven't really, you know, made their peace with this. So in terms of what we think, I think that's going to depend on what we know in some respects. In terms of the forces, though, there is an interesting issue that comes up. You know, one is that getting military training can now be seen as a stepping stone to a career. And in fact, some people have alluded to the fact that they are getting military training and then they will retire and start their own private security company. And so in a sense, the career prospects for the active duty force may be enhanced by the possibility of being a contractor later on.
And not military careers. You're talking about getting training and then leaving the military.
Right. And then leaving. And, you know, which is the other point I was going to bring up, which is that might help with recruitment. But retention is another big question mark. And in the U.S., in Britain, in Australia, and in Chile, there has been a larger than average separation of special forces kinds of personnel from the service during the Iraqi conflict. And many people are following that very closely to see whether, you know, sort of private sector competition is in fact drawing people out of the service more quickly, which, you know, could come back to haunt you in some ways because it's quite costly, obviously, to train forces, and you would want them to stay in and serve the country sort of long enough to recoup that benefit before they go off to the private sector to sell those skills.
Well, this isn't the first time.
I was going to say that raises one of the interesting issues that hasn't been fully explored. The hemorrhage of people from special forces is a pretty obvious manifestation of how, you know, the grass being greener on the contractor side of the fence may be in some respects hurting the U.S. military, because it takes about 10 years to, you know, train a special forces operator, and you invest an incredible amount of time and effort in doing that. And then if the guy woman is leaving to take a higher paying job in the private sector, you know, then the country has experienced a loss. But also, you know, there was a piece in the news again today about Halliburton overcharging the Department of Defense, you know, for various services provided in Iraq. You know, that's another issue. I mean, in the old days when you had Private Snuffy Smith peeling potatoes in the kitchen, you pretty much had a good handle on what your costs were. But now when you've contracted, you know, all the kitchen services out to KBR or Halliburton, you run into the sorts of problems that, you know, we've seen many times over the course of the last year. How can you control costs? And doesn't this open up, you know, the sorts of problems that we've traditionally had in the defense contracting sector?
Mike Desch is the author of Civilian Control of the Military, The Changing Security Environment. He's a political scientist at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. We are talking today about the private contractors in Iraq and the way that their presence there might affect the way we evaluate that situation. We're going to take some calls in a little while. Our number is 888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. We're also talking today with Deborah Avant, who's a political scientist at George Washington University, and her forthcoming book is called The Market for Force, Private Security and Political Change. Deborah Avant, let's talk about public support. I'd like to know whether the presence of contractors influences the process of getting and in particular keeping public support for military action, for Iraq or any other military action that the U.S. might want to undertake.
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one that unfortunately I don't have a very good answer for. We are in the process now of really trying to understand what the impact of having contractors on the battlefield is for public support. One of the interesting things, though, is that when political leaders are thinking about the costs of certain kinds of engagements, the fact that they have contractors as a possibility allows them to make commitments with fewer amounts of U.S. forces. And certainly in the political realm, that seemed to be to reduce the political cost of using force. And so you can imagine that being able to use contractors would increase the number of foreign engagements that a government might be willing to engage in. And let me give you just two examples. In the 1990s, the U.S. was interested in engaging in Bosnia to try to ameliorate the conflict there. There wasn't a lot of public support for it. And the Clinton administration was able, with the use of private contractors, to do some training of the Croatian forces, which had an impact on the resolution of that conflict. In the lead up to the war in Iraq, of course, some people were suggesting that the war would take many, many more soldiers than the administration was willing to commit. And the administration, you know, argued that we could do it with fewer soldiers, and we have done it with fewer soldiers. And when things got tough, the private sector has allowed the administration to sort of keep, you know, the handle that it has been able to keep on Iraq. And so to some extent, the private sector may allow administrations to pursue policies that might not have the same level of public support that might be required if you're using forces.
Does that tend to push in the direction of more conflict? It sounds like it could.
Well, it could push in the direction of more what I call adventurous foreign policy, meaning foreign policy using force in ways that may not have the same amount of public support that would be required if we were using our own forces.
Mike Desch, what is your take on this? I mean, you've spent a lot of time thinking about the relationship of the military to the rest of the population. How do private contractors affect that relationship and affect the possibilities for generating and keeping public support for military action?
Well, I think that most of the time the contractors keep a pretty low profile. As Debbie said before, you know, part of the reason for using contractors, aside from the flexibility or, you know, the economics of it, are to be able to do stuff under the radar screen. As she mentioned, in the 90s, we used Military Professional Resources International basically to rebuild the Croatian army and turn the tide in Bosnia. And, you know, look at the number of contractors, you know, the CIA has been using recently in both Afghanistan and in Iraq as well. I really think that this is, for the most part, a below the radar screen issue. And I don't think the public has, you know, fully gotten its arms around this issue yet. And again, I think the issue is going to be when the public fully appreciates the magnitude of contractor participation in what we normally think of as military operations. Are they going to feel good about it, or are they going to regard these people as mercenaries? And is this going to further distance the public from the foreign policy that a particular administration might push? I'm not sure which way it'll go.
You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Our conversation today is about the private contractors in Iraq and the way that their presence might influence our perceptions of what's going on there. Our number is 888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. Deborah Avant, let me put a different spin on what you were saying before about policy options that might be available to a government. Okay, so you have a private sector which can supply something, and if you want it, you can go and get it. That gives you a broader range of choices. But is there a more direct way in which private contractors might influence policymaking in the way, say, another company that's regulated by the government might participate in the policymaking process?
Yes, and we've actually seen this already when private contractors are providing key services to the U.S. government. They often are also providing information and analysis in ways that might affect foreign policy decision making. And this is particularly the case, or I've seen it particularly, in the way the U.S. has used the private sector to do military training of foreign forces abroad, where often the information the U.S. has about how those troops are doing is really dependent on the contractor or the host government. And so if we're getting information about, how our training efforts are going in Croatia from either MPRI or the Croatian government, that is influencing the U.S. ability to ascertain and evaluate the impact of that training.
So they're getting like biased information.
Well, potentially. It's also the case that when the private sector is giving this kind of information, it can put the best spin on it for its own purposes in terms of future contracts. And certainly, when you look at MPRI's efforts, first in training the Croatian military, and then once that military did its job in Operation Storm, and the Dayton Accords came about, it got another contract training the Bosnian military. MPRI is still working in the Balkans, training a variety of different militaries over there.
So have you seen it affect the questions about the deployment of U.S. military forces? Deborah Avant.
In terms of the actual deployments of military forces, I'm not sure that I've seen a direct impact. Mm-hmm. I would say that in the lead up to the current war in Iraq, the fact that as many support functions as were provided by the private sector were reduced the number of troops that Rumsfeld could say we would need in ways that did probably encourage a decision to go to war as opposed to discourage it.
All right, let's take another break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, and we will take some phone calls. Our number, which is toll-free, is 888-859-1800. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Our conversation today is about private contractors in Iraq and the way they might be, their presence might affect the way we evaluate that situation. Our guests are political scientists Deborah Avant and Michael Desch. Our number once again, 888-859-1800. Let's take a call. Let's talk with Frank. Hello, Frank, you're on Odyssey.
Hi. Yeah, my contention is, from what I've been reading in the magazines and papers and stuff, is since Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense for the first Bush, and way before that, he's been working toward privatizing the military with Halliburton. And now it seems that over the past several years, you know, when he became vice president, he was able to push more and more toward privatizing it and getting them involved in multi-billion dollar contracts with the government. And when the CIA and the DIA found no evidence of Iraq being a threat, then they formed their own Office of Special Plans within the Pentagon to reanalyze information that was discarded as bad. So then Dick Cheney had the power to whisper in a president's ear, we need to go to war. We need to go to war. And my contention is this is all about the private sector.
Well, let's get your reactions to that. Deborah Avant, it's certainly everything that you and Mike Desch have been saying today would make it difficult or more difficult to refute an argument like Frank's.
Yeah, I think that the the argument that there's a real direct connection is hard to substantiate. And yet the sort of general impression that the private sector, the private defense firms do tend to benefit from this type of conflict, and that in some respects, the Iraqi conflict was an elective war, does point to some level of connection.
Mike Desch?
Gretchen, if I might. I think there are two separate problems that the caller is pointing to. The problem of sort of the iron triangle of a too cozy relationship between people in power and people who are just out of power, who are in the private sector, is a long-standing one. I mean, we've seen the revolving door of former military officers or former senior civilians in defense then going into the defense industry and causing the sorts of problems that, you know, we're currently having with Halliburton, you know, going all the way back to the 1950s. So in that sense, I'm not sure that this problem is really new. Conversely, the problem of Cheney exercising disproportionate influence, I don't think is a function of the fact that he was CEO of Halliburton in between being SecDef and vice president. I think that's
a
different sort of problem. So I think what we ought to focus on are the more prosaic, but I think equally serious problems of the changing relationship between the military and the private sector, but also recognize that it's not a completely new phenomenon.
If I could just add, though, sure. It's absolutely not a completely new phenomenon, but it is one that has moved from weapon systems now into services, giving it sort of a larger presence in American foreign policy generally.
All right, let's take another call. Frank, thanks for your call. Let's talk with Cheryl. Hello, Cheryl. You're on Odyssey.
Hi. We've been dealing a lot with how the general public feels about these contract workers, but my question goes to more how the enlisted forces feel about them. We've been hearing, if nothing else, that these contractors are making upwards of $1,000 per day, and that in contrast to these reservists and, in many cases, the enlisted forces who are undergoing financial hardship. What I'd like to know is if there is any resentment by the enlisted forces to these contract workers, or if they're feeling, in fact, undervalued. And I'll take the response offline.
Okay, that's a good question. Mike Desch, you mentioned that the soldiers have reasons to want to keep their distance from the private contractors because it's not clear what rules they operate under. But Cheryl's question is an interesting one. Do you know what that sort of level of reaction is?
Well, I haven't heard anything firsthand. Debbie may have spoken, you know, with people more recently about this. I mean, on the one hand, if you're a reservist who is stuck in for up to 2 years on a stop-loss order and getting paid regular active duty rate, and you're seeing somebody else over there making considerably more money, I can't help but think that it wouldn't engender a little animosity. On the other hand, though, I'm not sure that, you know, necessarily the full scope of the contractor presence is obvious to, you know, every enlisted person, even those deployed in theater, because a lot of this stuff that's going on, people wouldn't see on a regular basis.
Yeah, I do think that there is there's an interesting juxtaposition. On the one hand, you do have a lot of people talking about the fact that they can't wait till their tour is over so they can come back working for one of these contractors. So they may see sort of a future benefit.
So the revolving door is right in Iraq?
Right in Iraq, right in the Balkans. This has been going on, you know, for quite some time, actually. On the other hand, to the extent that contractors are doing exactly what active duty personnel do, you do tend to see resentment. And, you know, this is the case even in the U.S. when the Navy hires private contractors to help paint the ships, and they're working right alongside the active duty personnel, but they get to go home at 5 and get weekends off, and they're getting paid overtime, and the active duty personnel are not. And in those kinds of situations, you do see greater resentment, and that's what I've heard, you know, sort of on the ground with the number of private security personnel in Iraq. It's the people that are, you know, when you have MPs that are guarding Kellogg, Brown, and Root convoys, and then private personnel that are guarding Bremer's force, you basically have active duty and private sector personnel doing almost exactly the same job, and that is a recipe for resentment.
All right, let's take another call. Let's talk with Susan. Hi, Susan, you're on Odyssey.
Hi, thanks a lot. This is a terrific program. I was thinking about what you're saying in the context of the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal, and I'm wondering, we're talking non-military, non-U.S. citizens. To what system of justice do they answer?
That's the $64,000 question. And it was sort of interesting, you know, in some of the preliminary discussions with some of the MPs who were involved, they said they weren't sure oftentimes who it was exactly that was doing the interrogations and, you know, who was giving the orders. You'd have people who, you know, had a military bearing, who were wearing BDUs, but, you know, with no rank insignia or no name tag and things like that. And they were, you know, they were frankly confused. And in fact, what was probably the case is that some of these guys working for Titan or CACI who were on contract to the CIA were probably ex-military types as well. And so it was, you know, very murky. But the question is, you know, for contractors who are involved in violations of the Geneva Conventions or, you know, other technical war crimes, it's not at all clear how they would be brought to justice, if ever. I mean, people are talking about, you know, these folks, if they're charged, being charged by the Department of Justice under U.S. law. But I could imagine that would be a lawyer's, you know, feast to try to untangle all the legal aspects of that.
Well, is there any incentive here to use private contractors because perhaps they can operate with more latitude than soldiers?
Well, there might be, but if you were doing that, you certainly wouldn't want to have them intertwined with soldiers at a prison. So I think that, you know, to the extent that there might be an incentive to use the private sector to evade restrictions, you would do it separately from military forces. I just might add one thing. There is a history here. DynE's a history here. DynE Corps, for instance, was some of its employees were accused of you know, running sex trade and brothel rings in the Balkans, and its employees were not prosecuted. Congress did pass some legislation in 1999-2000 called the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act that was designed to make contractors prosecutable in U.S. courts if the local courts couldn't prosecute them. And I imagine that will be the process for bringing these civilian contractors to justice, if that's what it comes to. One glitch in that legislation is that it only applies to contractors that are working for the Department of Defense. So if these contractors were working for the CIA, or the NSA, it will be more problematic to bring them to justice.
You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. We're talking today on the program about private contractors in Iraq and some of the complicated questions that their presence there raises, both for the military and for the American public. Let's take one more call. Let's talk with Terry. Hello, Terry. You're on Odyssey.
Thank you. My question has to do with broad historical parallels. As Rome arose from Greece, pretty much we arose from Britain, and as Rome started using more and more mercenaries, its moral character fell, and ultimately the empire collapsed. I see somewhat similar things now.
Deborah Avent?
There have been long stretches historically when contracted force has been quite prominent. And in fact, one of the most interesting times that I think parallels to this time is in actually the late Middle Ages, when there were contractors operating very much along the lines as contractors operate now, where personnel were actually trained as part of the feudal system and yet let out to do contracts with, you know, a wide variety of entities, you know, emerging states, other feudal lords, the Pope, whomever. And I think if you sort of look at the global market, that's a time that parallels most closely the time we're seeing now.
Michael Desch, we're getting near the end of our time. Let me ask you to you've been saying that we haven't yet sort of grasped the full impact of what the contractors are doing and their presence there. What do you think are the major or most significant things we're going to have to grapple with if we do, assuming we do, come to terms with this change?
Well, there are a number of things. First is the whole question of cost effectiveness. In the short term, you can, understand the logic that would lead the Department of Defense to, you know, rely upon contractors rather than trying to do things in-house. But you have to ask over the longer term, you know, whether in fact that really is cost effective. And Debbie's anecdote about the hemorrhage of special forces soldiers, I think, is a case in point. The other big issue is one of accountability that we've been talking about and that the Abu Ghraib, debacle has really made clear. In the old days, you could be relatively confident, not that your soldiers would always comport themselves, up to the best behavior, but rather when they didn't, that they would be relatively easily prosecutable through the Uniform Code of Military Justice. But in fact, as the presence of contractors, especially in sensitive positions, becomes more widespread, then this whole issue of how you control these folks becomes far more problematic. And I don't think we've fully come to grips with that problem either.
Michael Desch is a political scientist at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. He directs the Patterson School of Diplomacy there, and he's the author of Civilian Control of the Military, The Changing Security Environment. Deborah Avent, you and Mike are a little further ahead than the rest of us in grappling with this issue. In terms of what you've seen both for the U.S. military and around the world, what are the most significant changes that have already happened?
Well, I think already we're seeing a tendency to think about force as more of a private good than a public good. In Iraq, for instance, in the CPA's efforts to get a hold of the difficulties of the security environment, it's actually entertaining the possibility of having contractors like Bechtel, construction contractors, incorporate the cost of security into their bids and make them responsible for security. And when you think about it, that's really a far cry from assuming that the government is what provides security. And so I think that this actually poses some very serious things for the U.S. and people around the world to think about in terms of if the government isn't going to be the one that controls force, what will? And using the market to control force has some beneficial consequences and a lot of consequences that that are more problematic. And I think that that's something that people, all over the world are going to be dealing with.
Deborah Avant is a political scientist at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Her forthcoming book is The Market for Force, Private Security and Political Change. Deborah Avant and Michael Desch, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, Gretchen.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. Thanks to our research assistant, Neil Verma, our intern, Maura Waltz, and our production assistant, Ragnar Anderson. Our technical producer is Steve Warnauskas. Our program is produced by Allison Cuddy and Delia Lloyd. The senior producer of Odyssey is Joshua Andrews. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us again next time for Odyssey.
Funding for Odyssey is provided by generous grants from Doris Sasser, the Staines family, and the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. The views expressed are not necessarily those of Chicago Public Radio, this station, or its sponsors. To listen again, visit our website, odysseyradio.org. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's odysseyradio.org.